is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
In the summer of 76, four ABA teams came in, including the Nets with Julius. However, there was a major contract dispute that Julius was having with the owner about his contract, and he elected to forego training camp, and that created all sorts of rumblings. And so I stayed in touch with the Nets, just trying to find out what they might be thinking of doing. And eventually I heard from them, and they said, we'll move him, but our owner needs cash. And I said, how much? He said, $3 million. And after gasping, I said, well, then what's it going to take to sign Julius? He said, another three. I wasn't much of a math student, but I was able to total that up. And it came to $6 million. So I went out to visit our new owner. He had just bought the team. His name was Fitz Dixon. Loved sports, although he had not really been involved with basketball. And I explained to him that this guy, Julius Erving, was available. Well, what will it take to get him? I said, money. How much? And I explained this number of $6 million. And then he looked at me and he said, tell me, Pat, are you recommending this deal? And I said, yes, sir, I am. And then he then said, well, then go get it done.
Pat Williams is a Basketball Hall of Famer, co-founder of the NBA's Orlando Magic, and former general manager of the Philadelphia 76ers. Also one of America's top motivational and inspirational corporate speakers, Pat has addressed employees from many of the Fortune 500 companies. Pat is also the author of over 100 books, his most recent title, highlighting the leadership secrets of the United States Military Academy at West Point, in character carved in stone. Pat has been the general manager with NBA teams in Chicago, Atlanta, Philadelphia, and Orlando, including the 1983 world champion Philadelphia 76ers. In 1996, Pat was named as one of the 50 most influential people in NBA history. In 2012, Pat received the John W. Bunn Lifetime Achievement Award from the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame. After you listen to my conversation with Pat Williams, jump over to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen and leave us a 5-star rating and review. To make sure you never miss an episode, subscribe right now and visit our website at www.hoopheadspod.com to find every episode we've ever recorded. Let your friends and colleagues in the game know about the show, so they can gain insights from some of the best minds in the game, from grassroots all the way to the NBA. Get ready to take some notes and be entertained by Basketball Hall of Famer Pat Williams, a true giant in the game. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here today without my co-host Jason Sunkel, but I am pleased to be able to welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast Pat Williams, Senior Vice President of the Orlando Magic. Pat, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mike. Good to be with you. How are you?
We are terrific today. The chance to have you on the show and talk to you a little bit about all the tremendous things that you've been able to do, not only in the game of basketball, but also in the game of life. But I want to start out by going back to your childhood, Pat, and asking you a question about how you got into sports as a kid. And I know you were a big baseball player when you were younger. So can you talk a little bit about your sort of upbringing in sports and maybe how that's influenced you as you've gone forward in your career?
Well, I grew up in Wilmington, Delaware, where my dad was a high school history teacher and coach, football and baseball coach. So I grew up in that environment around his high school teams. When I was 7, my father took me to my first major league ball game in Philadelphia, and I fell in love instantly with the sights and the sound and the smell and the color of baseball. And at age 7, I knew exactly what I wanted to do with my life. I wanted to be a ball player. And so from that age of 7 all the way through high school and then through college and into the pro ranks for a few years, I was determined to be a ball player and try to get as high as I could. I was a catcher. And that's what happened to my life from age 7 till, 23. I was just consumed with sports. Baseball was number one, but I played football in high school. I also played basketball. I was a fanatical basketball fan growing up in the Philadelphia area. And so that's how it all started for me, Mike. And eventually, you know, it turned out to be a career for me.
So who was your baseball player growing up that you looked up to?
Well, the A's and the Phillies were both in Philadelphia then. And so they played at Shibe Park, 21st and Lehigh in Philadelphia. So there was a major league game going on all the time between the A's and the Phillies. And I was there every weekend. So I loved the old A's, Ferris Fain and Eddie Joost, Bobby Shantz. I loved the Phillies, Robin Roberts and Richie Ashburn and Kurt Simmons and Del Ennis. Those were my boyhood heroes. They're the ones that I grew up watching, and they still remain. You know, those first loves you have in sports never go away, and they still remain my boyhood heroes.
Yeah, I believe it. What about on the basketball side?
Well, back then, the Philadelphia Warriors were in town with the great Paul Arizin and Neil Johnston and Joe Grabowski. Those were the pro players I grew up with. But right at that point at the Philadelphia Palestra, the five colleges in Philadelphia had started what became known as the Big Five. And they brought in teams from all over the country. There was a scintillating Palestra doubleheader every night of the season. And I, on a Friday or a Saturday, I was there with my buddies, you know, every time. Villanova, LaSalle, St. Joe's, Temple, and Penn were the Big Five schools in the historic Palestra. So from the time I was about 13 all the way through high school, that's where I spent my weekends.
That's very cool. The Palestra, it's amazing what a historic venue that it is, and the fact that it's still around and such a piece of the fabric of the city of Philadelphia that is still around today that people can go and catch a game there. And it's obviously college basketball, I'd say, is not quite as dominant as it was back in your time or my time, which is unfortunate. But it's still great that the Palestra is around and those Big Five schools still, you know, are able to attract teams to be able to play and get people to go in and see that great venue and be able to participate there. What did you, when your baseball playing career ended, because obviously you mentioned that you wanted to try to get to the highest level that you can, and you played a couple minor league seasons, when you started to see the writing on the wall that your baseball playing career was going to end, and then you had an opportunity to transition into the front office or into the, you know, more of the business side of the game. Can you talk a little bit about how that transition took place?
I was very fortunate. The general manager of the Phillies Farm Club in Miami, a man named Bill Durney, saw something in me as a young player that would translate over into the front office. So he made it clear to the Phillies in Philadelphia that he would like to have me come and work under him. I did that for the 1964 season and just had a marvelous year under his tutelage. It was very significant for me. And I was prepared to go back for another go at it in Miami in 1965. However, the Phillies came to me, and the GM job was open in Spartanburg, South Carolina, which was another farm club of theirs, and they wanted me to go there as the 24-year-old GM of the Spartanburg Phillies. It was a huge opportunity. It came very suddenly, and I accepted it, moved to Spartanburg. And that's where I was for the next 4 years, learning the ropes of professional baseball at that level and making my way in the game of baseball. And that's where all my goals and dreams were.
So what were some of the biggest things that you had to learn when you stepped into that job as a 24-year-old? Do you remember back to that time? Like, what were some things that maybe you were unprepared for or things that you felt like, ooh, I got to get better at this if I want to be successful at this job?
Well, I was thrust into a position of leadership, although back then you didn't use that word very often. But there were so many things facing me. We had an old ballpark that needed to be rehabbed and painted. The attendance over the years had not been very good. And so I had to immediately transition and start selling and promoting and trying to get fans interested, companies interested in supporting the ball club. And all of that was thrown at me directly. Fortunately, the owner of the team, a man named Ari Littlejohn, took a great interest in me. And that remained the case, you know, for all the years, you know, until he passed away years back. He was always there for me, never interfering, never overwhelming me or, you know, or telling me what to do. But he would always listen, always offered advice, always offered great wisdom. And I think that accelerated my growth as a young baseball guy, probably by 10 or 15 years. So everything that has ever happened to me in sports since really began in Spartanburg. Everything that you could encounter in the sports world, I encountered there. And so it was a real proving ground for me.
What was your strength at that time? What do you think you were really good at kind of right out of the gate? What's something that you felt like you had a natural affinity for in the job?
I had been greatly influenced in those early years by the great Bill Veeck, the Baseball Hall of Fame executive and known for his flamboyant promotional style. Bill had become a friend, a mentor, a great influence in my life. And so I wanted to take his approach to promoting and marketing and selling the sport of baseball. I wanted to take it with me right to Spartanburg, and I was able to do that. Bill's approach was don't sell the game on the won and loss column because it's too risky. You just don't know what your team's going to do. But he said you can guarantee your fan base a great time of entertainment and fun every night. And so we began to do that. Fortunately, in those years, the Phillies put some very strong teams there, some championship teams with future major league players. And that did nothing but add to what we were doing. But we promoted every night, had something going on every night. It demanded, well, a lot of creativity, a lot of imagination. But that's what drove me, and that's what I thought was the important thing to do. And in the process, we began to set attendance records, and the eyes of minor league baseball were really focused on us there for quite a while.
Yeah, can you talk about how visionary that was at the time? Because obviously now people who go to a professional sporting event, you know, you have anytime there's a timeout or there's halftime and there's entertainment and there's, you know, between innings, there's always things going on. But at that time, that was not really the concept of what was out there. So can you just talk a little bit about how visionary that was from Bill Veeck and what just how unusual that was at that time?
Well, Bill and what he was doing back in the 40s and the 50s was probably 50 years ahead of his time. Not many minor league teams were doing that, but Bill had a huge, huge influence on me and convinced me to do at that level what he had been pioneering. Now, I didn't have a major league budget, but we began to do it, and anything that was clean and legal and moral, you know, we were doing it at our ballpark, trying to lure the marginal fan or the non-fan to come out. We didn't want to rely on an army of baseball purists. There just weren't enough of them around.
So what were one or two of the promotions that you remember from that time that really went over well with people?
Well, it's a good question. I do remember prior to the 1966 season, the Phillies out of spring training sent us two pitchers. One was John Parker. The other was John Penn. Well, if you think about it, that demands that you have a Parker Penn night. So I talked to Bill about it, and he put me in touch with the Parker Penn people in Wisconsin, and they bought it. They liked it and provided us with a whole arsenal of Parker Penn products for this big promotional night. And we were set for a big one at beautiful Duncan Park. And then everything went wrong. John Parker's wife was going to deliver a baby that day. No, John Penn's wife. And John Parker got called up by his Army Reserve unit. And then the biggest thunderstorm in the history of Spartanburg County descended. And the whole night went down the drain.
The best laid plans, Pat. The best laid plans.
Fortunately, the pens were dry. And later on in the season, we did it again. John Penn's family was settled then. And John Parker got a pass from the Army. And we did it all over again. That would be an example. Now, you can't sit down in the wintertime and plan Parker Penn night. Because you don't know, we didn't know until the week before the season, those two guys were even coming to Spartanburg. So I think to have an open mind, be creative, things are always going to be popping if you're alert to them. Things in your community or things even of a national scope that might be fun, might be interesting. And that's the beauty of operating a minor league ball club, because you can do all that. In the big leagues, it's tough to, you know, do a lot of the things you do. I think the greatest promoting is going on in minor league baseball, where you have to use your ingenuity and your creativity. You don't have a big budget. And I think those are the sharpest promoters going on right now in minor league baseball.
Yeah, I could see that. They don't have the big name players to sell. They don't have the big name venues. So you're trying to get people in the door. I can totally see that. So talk about how you got the opportunity to move to the Minnesota Twins after your stint in the minor leagues.
Well, that came much later, Mike. I did end up back in baseball when I got here to Orlando. But I was prepared and working towards a career in baseball and hoping for that big break. But in July of 1968, it was the middle of my fourth season in Spartanburg, I walked into the ballpark one day, and there was a pink phone message to return to a Jack Ramsey in Inglewood, California. Well, the only Jack Ramsey I knew of was the basketball coach at St. Joe's in Philadelphia. He was then the general manager of the 76ers, and I couldn't imagine what this call was about. Well, I returned the call. And yes, it was that Jack Ramsey. And he explained to me that he was going to keep his GM duties, but also become the coach of the 76ers that fall. He needed somebody to run the front office and wanted to know if I would be interested. Well, I went up to Philadelphia to visit with the people there, Jack and the owner, and spent two visits there. And the end of the second visit, they offered me the job. 3-year contract, $20,000 a year, which was big bucks, by the way, back then. That was big.
Absolutely.
And so after this stint in the Phillies organization, I left and moved to the 76ers. And spent that year taking all of my minor league promotional stuff and moved it right to Philadelphia. Something many said, oh, you can't do that. You know, they'll never buy all that stuff you're doing in a big city. Well, I was determined to show that it would go, and had a very, very eventful season, that 68-69 season. It was a great experience for me. Thought the world of Jack Ramsey. And then 1 year later, in July of 1969, the Chicago Bulls GM post was open. I heard from them, and they wanted to talk to me. And I went out there with Jack's blessing and met with them, and they offered me the position as the GM of the Chicago Bulls. And after the 1 year, I left Philadelphia, and that started this long 50-year path, Mike, winding through the NBA.
Is it hard to believe when you look back on it that, you know, you obviously started out with the idea that you were going to spend the majority of your career in baseball, and you ended up making the biggest name for yourself and spending the most amount of time on the basketball side of it? Is that hard to believe when you look back?
Well, it's funny, Mike. I've always had you know, a strong faith in God. And I believe that there is a plan and purpose to our life, and that we don't see the whole picture, you know, out of the chute. You know, we take it piece by piece, experience by experience. But yes, in the beginning, I never could have seen all that unfolding. You know, I pictured myself getting to the big leagues in baseball and perhaps becoming a baseball general manager someday. That's really what I was shooting for. But God had other plans, and out of a clear blue sky, here comes this offer to go to the 76ers and start a whole new career in another sport. Yeah, that was not something that I had planned or drawn out, but after that call from Jack Ramsey, that's exactly what happened.
That's a pretty good guy to get a call from.
Well, he was a, I knew him. I knew of him. Never had met him. You know, as I said, I was a big college fan and went to the Palestra many times. Saw Jack Ramsey coaching the St. Joe's Hawks. Knew of him, had a great respect from a distance as a teenager, and loved watching his teams play, and was a big Hawks fan. And so when he called and wanted to talk to me, yes, that was quite a thrill.
So you go through, you're with the Bulls for a few years, and then you move on to the Atlanta Hawks, where you trade Pete Maravich.
Well, I spent 4 years with the Bulls. That was a great, great time. I love Chicago, still do. And to see that Bulls team that we put together really begin to grow and expand and become a consistent playoff team with some very interesting players, Jerry Sloan and Chet Walker, Bob Love, Tom Boerwinkel, that group. Many, many Chicago fans of that era still have great memories of that team. And after the fourth year, I had an interesting thing happen. It was time to leave the Bulls. There was a new ownership group that had come in, and it was obvious that it was my time to move on. And within a few days, I had two phone calls I heard from two teams. One was the Atlanta Hawks. The other was the Baltimore Orioles. And their president, Frank Cashin, offered me the GM post over the phone.
Wow.
I could have gotten back into baseball right there, but I went down and visited Atlanta, and I just decided that, you know, I've really gotten some roots here in the NBA. I like this league. I'm enjoying my time in it, and I told the Orioles I was going to move on and stay and go to Atlanta. I've often thought what might have happened if I had not done that, but I just felt at the time it was time to continue in the NBA. So we moved to Atlanta, spent a year with the Hawks. It was a tough year. Didn't go as we had planned. And Pistol Pete Maravich at that time was a very troubled soul. He had all sorts of issues in his life, and it just wasn't working. Cotton Fitzsimmons was our coach. He came to me one day and said, you know, see what you can get for Pete. He said, I just think we need to move on. So I shopped him around, and there really was no interest. However, there was a new expansion team coming into the league at that point in New Orleans, and their ownership thought if we could bring Pistol back, you know, after his great time in LSU, that would really fly well here. So we cut a deal and got all sorts of draft picks from New Orleans, and then we had to go inform Pete that we traded him. That was a tough assignment. He had deep roots in Atlanta, but that the deal took place. And later that summer, I heard from the 76ers again, and they were in need of a general manager. They thought I would be the proper guy, and I met with them, and they offered me the job. And I left Atlanta. I got back home, went to work for the Sixers. Spent 12 memorable years there from 1974 to 1986, and never will forget that time in Philly.
Yeah, I'm sure that was, you know, you were talking about some of your heroes when you were growing up, and I was born in 1970. So my very first basketball hero was Julius Erving. And so the 76-77 team that played against the Trailblazers, and I have vague recollections of those teams, and and Doc coming out of the ABA, and then obviously the championship team in 82-83, those 83 Sixers, the faux Moses Malone prediction prior to the playoffs. Those are some of my favorite, some of my favorite memories growing up or thinking about those teams. So can you talk a little bit about what it was like bringing Doc over from the ABA and what that process was like first?
Well, the two leagues had merged in the summer of 76. Four ABA teams came in, including the Nets with Julius. However, there was a major contract dispute that Julius was having with the owner about his contract, and he elected to forego training camp. And that created all sorts of rumblings. And so I stayed in touch with the Nets, just trying to find out what they might be thinking of doing. And eventually I heard from them and he said, we'll move him, but our owner needs cash. And I said, how much? He said, $3 million. And after gasping, I said, well, then what's it going to take to sign Julius? He said, another three. I wasn't much of a math student, but I was able to total that up, and it came to $6 million. So I went out to visit our new owner. He had just bought the team. His name was Fitz Dixon. Loved sports, although he had not really been involved with basketball. And I explained to him that this guy Julius Erving was available. Well, what'll it take to get him? I said, money. How much? And I explained this number of $6 million. And then he looked at me and he said, tell me, Pat, are you recommending this deal? And I said, yes, sir, I am. And then he then said, well, then go get it done.
That's the kind of owner you want to work for.
Yeah. And that was the end of the meeting. And we dashed off to New York with a battery of lawyers. We had to make a deal with the Nets. We also had to make a deal with Julius's people and work through that the night. And by the next morning, it was done. Both deals were done. We announced it that Thursday afternoon, evening, what had happened, and opened the season the next night against the other ABA team, the San Antonio Spurs, with the great George Gervin. And Julius, after no training camp, was in uniform and played that night. So, and that started a long run. Julius was in with the Sixers for over a decade. Became a beloved figure in that city and still is. And a remarkable player and a really remarkable person.
Yeah, I think, you think back to that time and the ABA and just how, I don't want to say hidden that league was, but just there was so many great players in the ABA. And yet because there was no TV contract and just the players weren't as well known. And obviously Doc had been known when he was at UMass. But, when he came to the NBA, it was kind of, I think, a revelation. I just remember him kind of bursting onto the scene and just becoming a fan of, Dr. J and his Converse shoes and the dunk contest and just the personalities that those early Sixers teams had. And so can you talk a little bit about just, you mentioned about what kind of player and person Doc was. Can you tell maybe a story about something that sticks out in your mind about the time that you were able to be with Dr. J and what that was like?
Well, I was always impressed that Julius had time for everybody. The media, for example, it didn't matter whether you were the lead columnist for the New York Times or a high school sports editor, he would treat the media all the same. He had time for everybody. He always had time to sign an autograph. He was patient with people. It was really beautiful to watch. The way he handled himself and the way he dealt with people in such a kind and gentle way. That's why to this day, people are so fond of Julius. because he truly had an interest in other people and never tried to big time anybody. I think that's what really has stuck with me more than anything. He was a great player, obviously. He was a great teammate. Treated the game with great respect, treated referees with respect, treated coaches with respect. There's really, when you study Julius, so much that any athlete could take from him, you know, and apply to their lives as well.
So what are those, some of those things that you would point to if you were talking to a young athlete, whether that be a high school athlete, a college athlete, or an athlete that's early in their pro career? What are some things that they could learn from the way that Dr. J handled himself and handled his career?
Well, first of all, he worked awfully hard at developing his game. You know, he had some, obviously some physical gifts, but he never shortcut himself. You know, he worked extremely hard. Secondly, he was always more interested in the team than he was in his own individual successes. That was something that always stood out. Thirdly, as I just mentioned, he had great respect for the game, and he respected his teammates. He respected his opponents, respected coaches, respected, you know, the other players, you know, around the league. And that's why people were so impressed with him. The media was so impressed with him. And the other thing I would say is, maybe the best word is humility. You know, Julius was at the top of his game. He was famous beyond famous. Everybody in the world knew who he was, you know, who followed sports. But whenever you were around him, there was just a very, very sweet, humble spirit about him. He understood that he'd been gifted, that God had given him some remarkable gifts. I don't think he ever took it for granted. I don't ever think you never heard him bragging or, you know, trying to impress people with a lot of big time talk. A truly humble superstar.
Registration is now open at www.headstartbasketball.com for this summer's Head Start Basketball Camps. We'll be hosting camps this summer in Strongsville, Westlake, Avon Lake, Oberlin, Brunswick, Highland Heights, Mentor, and Hudson. At Head Start Basketball, we care deeply about making a positive impact on the lives of young basketball players, both on and off the court. It's through building strong relationships with our players, parents, and coaching staff that we are able to use the game of basketball to enrich the lives of those we interact with, both inside and outside of our organization. We believe that our attention to detail, our growth mindset, and our commitment to lifelong learning allows us to help our players achieve their fullest potential. We are passionately committed to providing players, parents, and coaches with everything they need to reach their goals. These core values run through everything we do. Check out our website, www.headstartbasketball.com, and discover why you should attend a Head Start Basketball Camp this summer. Hope to see you there.
So how important was that in your career as a GM? How much time did you spend as you're trying to determine which players you're going to bring to your team or which players that you need to remove from your team? How important was that character, leadership, good teammate piece of it? Because just from knowing your background and what you're all about, it seems like obviously those things would be paramount in your idea of what it takes to build a successful team.
Well, you've got to have talent to play in this league. You've got to have extraordinary talent. But character counts. It truly counts. You know, if you have a team with players who don't understand the importance of honesty and don't understand the importance of integrity, who are unwilling to take responsibility, who will be cutting corners, you know, in their work ethic, who give coaches nightmares. You know, the talent just won't carry you but a certain length. And so every organization is interested in great talent, but they also spent a lot of time trying to determine what is the overall character of this player we're about to sign or draft, and then give him a lot of guaranteed money. Character, yeah. Character counts in every level, and without it, our country goes to pieces. We don't have a country if character is not an issue.
That's for sure. That is for sure. So during this era, you guys are banging on the door as a team to try to get an NBA championship, and obviously, we know how important that was to Doc and to the other members of the team. And so you have an opportunity to acquire Moses Malone and kind of add that final piece to your championship puzzle to help you to get over the hump. Can you talk about how it came to be that you guys were able to acquire Moses and then just what he meant to that team that ended up winning the title against the Lakers in 83?
Well, in the summer of 1982, Moses was a free agent with Houston. His agent, Lee Fentress, was shopping him around to try and get the contract they wanted. And it hadn't really taken place until the 76ers suddenly emerged as a major factor here. We had traded Daryl Dawkins to New Jersey, and there was an opening, and we became very aggressive in pursuing Moses. And we found out that Moses wanted to come to Philly, that it made sense to him, and that he was excited about it. He did want to meet with the coach, Billy Cunningham, to make sure that there was be a right fit. I never will forget Moses saying, "This is Doc's team. This is Doc's team. I don't want to interfere with Doc." Well, Doc, you know, couldn't have been happier to have that kind of inside presence. So we signed Moses to a $13 million deal, which in the summer of 1982 was absolutely flabbergasting to the whole sports world. It just overwhelmed people. They did what? Couldn't believe it. Today, well, that might sound your 12th man. But,
right, exactly.
Back then, it was an enormous step. So Moses arrived that fall of 82, and we just had that 82-83 season, best described as a Cinderella season. Everything went right. There were no major injuries. We only lost a handful of games, won most games by big scores. The players all got along. Everybody knew their role. Everybody accepted their role. And it was a season that, you would have a hard time trying to recreate a season like that. The playoffs went crisply. You know, we swept the Knicks in four. Then came Milwaukee, a very, very talented Milwaukee team. And we got by them 4-1. And then came the Lakers in the finals. And keep in mind, the Lakers had knocked us out in 1980. They knocked us out in 1982. We had not figured out a way to beat them. But now here comes Moses, and we beat the Lakers in 4 straight. And it was just a huge moment of relief in Philadelphia. It was a huge moment of celebration. The community just poured themselves out in a dramatic celebratory day. Never will forget it. And to this day, many years later, that 82-83 team is celebrated and remembered, and there's a fondness in people's heart up that way.
So here's a question that I always have for teams that have won championships, whatever the level is. Does that group of players still get together at all ever and sort of have a reunion at all? Or is it more just guys occasionally talk? Or how connected are you to any of those players still today?
Well, on several occasions, the 76ers have brought that gang back for a moment of celebration, you know, around a 76er game. I know of at least two memorable times when they've done that. And yes, these guys are in touch with each other. We lost Moses a few years ago.
Yeah.
But the rest of the players are all in good health, and they stay in touch with each other. And there's a chemistry there that'll be there for life.
Yeah, I'm sure that's the case. Talk about your decision to draft Charles Barkley later on after that 83 championship season, when you had an opportunity to draft Barkley. Talk about what you saw back at the time when you were able to draft Charles out of Auburn.
We had an extra pick that year in a trade long before from the Clippers, and we knew that was going to be a draft of great significance. This was the Michael Jordan draft. This was Hakeem Olajuwon. And so we watched the draft unfolding, and we knew what would happen. Well, there were a few surprises. Houston went with the hometown center, Olajuwon. Then Portland stepped up and took another center by the name of Sam Bowie from Kentucky, because they needed a big man. And that meant Michael Jordan was still on the board, and the Bulls took him. We were watching all of this, you know, in just fascinated. And now it was Dallas's turn to pick. And they selected Sam Perkins from North Carolina. A good pick. Big left-hander. Went on and played, must have played 18 years in the league. And now, with the fifth pick, here we are. What to do? Well, we had Charles in for a couple of visits. We had seen him, fascinated by him, scared of him. You know, he was about, he was more 6'4 than 6'5. I mean, and wide. I mean, we weighed him. He was 292 pounds. And we explained to him, Charles, this, you know, that's not going to work. Well, we went ahead and gambled, and we took him. The draft was beginning to kind of shrivel up a little bit at that point. Anyway, we took him, and that started Charles' career in the NBA. And what a career it was. People forget how extraordinarily talented he was. There was not much on the basketball court he couldn't do. He could run. He could rebound. He could pass. He could dribble. He could score in abundance. Oh, he was fascinating. And had a good run in Philly. Finally forced his way out of there, and that's how he ended up in Phoenix. He was frustrated and wanted to win a title. Everybody does. But he's still remembered very fondly in Philadelphia.
Absolutely.
And we get to watch him almost every night during the season.
That's for sure. Now, let me ask you this. When you drafted him and you interviewed him in the pre-draft, and then you were with him, obviously, for several years, did you ever foresee that he would be a commentator on TV like he is now? I mean, obviously, he was always somewhat outspoken, but did you ever see him being able to get to the point where – he could be on TV on a nightly basis the way he is now?
I think we probably could have seen that. You know, he was very glib and very talkative, very colorful way back, you know, as a young guy. And I think they just carried on. So, yeah, I think we saw a lot of that right from the get-go. Now, he's become a mega celebrity with all of this. And handled it well. He's still a very great guy to be around. Every time I see Charles, he's always warm. He's friendly. Always, you know, he's handled his success, I think, very, very well.
Who are some of the guys? We'll jump to your Orlando experience here in a second, but I think this is a good point to ask this question. What guys from the course of your career are you closest to today? Like, are there players that you talk to on a pretty regular basis? Who are the guys you would say you're closest to at this point in your career?
Well, maybe Bobby Jones, who we brought to Philadelphia from Denver in 1978. Bobby lives in Charlotte. He's remained a he and his wife have remained good friends. We have lots in common. Whenever I see Julius, you know, it's always a very warm experience. I hear from our backup center, Clem Johnson, a great deal. He lives here in Florida, so I do hear from him. And so those are a few names that come to mind.
Gotcha. All right, so you get done at Philly. Let's talk about the Orlando experience and just how you came to be involved with the expansion Orlando Magic and what it was like putting together a franchise from scratch and being a part of that right from the get-go.
Well, I was in my 12th year in Philadelphia. We'd had good success. We'd won that championship. We got into the finals four times, but I was beginning to get a little restless. I felt that I needed a new challenge, and I had met some business leaders down here in Orlando, and they were convinced that pro basketball would go in Florida. They sold me on the fact that the future of Florida was right here in the central part of the state. So I up and resigned in Philadelphia, moved to Orlando in June of 1986, and we started the push to try and sell Orlando as a future site for the NBA. At the same time, other cities were jumping up, and they were going forward. Miami, Charlotte, Minnesota. This had never happened before, that there was that kind of interest in joining this league. So it was quite a time. And that whole time, from mid-June of 86 till mid-September, when the league began to examine these potential prospects, that was like a track meet here. We had to convince our community that we could do it. We had to get a building ready for inspection. We had to show the NBA and the commissioner that there was a real interest here. And that led to our campaign to get $100 deposits on season tickets to this team that nobody had committed to. There was no building here. There was no history of major league sports. And it was generally viewed as football country. But we were able to get deposits on 14,000 season tickets in 3 months and went to those owners' meetings in Phoenix in September of 1986, looking good. And they put us on the checklist. And of course, that next April, as it turns out, they took all four of the candidates.
Yeah, that was a time where that round of expansion, you know, it had been a while since, you know, obviously since the ABA merger, when you had the new teams come in, and then bringing in a whole new state, you know, in the state of Florida, that went from having zero teams to having two. And, you know, that expansion in the league brought in those new teams and made for some exciting new basketball and brought basketball to places that it hadn't previously been. I want to ask you about the naming process for the team, because that's one of the things that always fascinates me, is just you look at some team names of the teams that have been historic, that have been around forever, and you think about just, you know, the Celtics, the Knicks, and where those names come from. And then you think about the newer teams and just the process for naming. So can you kind of talk to us about what the process was like for naming the Magic back in that time, and how you eventually settled on calling the team the Magic, and maybe what another alternative or two that you had at that time were?
Well, we had a contest in the summer of 86, and the Orlando Sentinel ran it for us, and they took applications in from all over the place. I think over time we must add about 4,000 of them, and asking what their council, what the fans thought, and what would be a good name for this potential basketball team. And we had a committee, and they began to whittle it down. There were a lot of crazy name suggestions, but they began to whittle it down, and eventually there was a pattern with the three or four names that kept being repeated. One of them was the Heat. We didn't like that because, Florida has heat, but we think of heat and humidity and mosquitoes, and so we didn't like heat. Somebody committed, said the Oranges, and we thought, well, all the Oranges have moved south because freezes here in Central Florida had killed them all off. So that wasn't super appropriate. Somebody did have the rays, you know, referring to the sun. We kind of like that. Mm-hmm. But then the word magic kept coming up a number of times. And I began to think it's not magician's magic or black magic. We wanted to make sure of that. But it's just the magic of Orlando in Central Florida. Vacations, golf courses, Mickey Mouse, fun, spring training, fresh orange juice, the Space Coast. You know, when people think of Orlando, well, they think of good times. You know, they come from all over the world, 75 million last year, you know, to experience a fun time. And so we settled on that, thought that captured it well, the magic of Orlando. So we became the Orlando Magic 33 years ago, and the name has held up well.
It really has. There's no question about that. I think it ended up being a very appropriate choice. And during your time with the Magic, you had an opportunity to become involved with another Hall of Fame player and personality and drafted Shaq. And then right after that, you were able to draft Penny, which was sort of controversial at the time, where most people, I think, originally when the ping pong ball came up for you guys, that a lot of people thought you were going to draft Chris Webber and pair Webber and Shaq, and instead you guys went another direction and ended up trading Chris after you had picked him and traded him to the Warriors for Penny Hardaway and some draft picks. So let's talk a little bit about Penny first. And then we'll jump back into Shaq. So explain what you saw in Penny Hardaway, because he was one of my favorite players back at that time. He was just so explosive and such a dynamic player with great vision and could score all over the floor and so athletic. And yet I think there were still a lot of people when that draft day trade went down that, you know, Webber was seen as a sure thing. And I think Penny was a lot more of an unknown at that point.
Well, Mike, you've said it all. I mean, I think you covered it thoroughly. That's exactly how it was viewed, but we saw something in Penny that we thought would really mesh well with Shaq, that the two of them would give us a inside presence and an outside presence. We hated to pass on Chris Webber, but we were so intrigued with Hardaway that we made that deal with the Warriors. We took Webber with the first pick. Their job was to take Penny on the third pick. We would then flip, and to flip, we would get three future firsts from the Warriors. We felt that was a deal for the ages.
Absolutely.
in other words, we got our player and had three future firsts as well. So that's what happened, and we had a good run with those guys. Unfortunately, Shaq decided in free agency to go to the Lakers. Penny never could stay healthy. Eventually, he had surgery on both knees, and he continued to play in the league, but he was never quite the same.
Yeah, you look at, I think, his career. If you look at those early first couple year highlights of his career, and in fact, I just happened to see those on Twitter within the last probably week. And he was just phenomenal, how athletic he was and what a great passer he was. And just, he was unbelievable. And I think it's one of the great lost careers in the NBA, that if he had been able to stay healthy, the type of career he could have had, he would have definitely been, I think, among the all-time greatest players of all time.
Well, I think that's true. You know, he had skills that were almost beyond definition. And but that's what happens in this league. It's, many players don't hold up physically. Penny is now off on a coaching career at Memphis, and looks like he's doing a superb job. So we're following him with great interest.
Just signed the number one recruiting class in the country.
Yeah, he's had quite a run early on up there. So it's going to be fun following Memphis.
All right. So I want to jump from what you were doing then to the various things that you're doing now. And obviously you're still involved with the Magic, so I want to touch on what your role is day to day there and then talk a little bit about your motivational speaking, your prolific career as an author, and your latest book. So let's start with what you're doing today, day to day, with the magic, and then we'll jump into the other two things.
Well, I've been doing a lot of things, Mike. I've been involved in every aspect of the Magic organization for these many, many years. A week or so ago, I announced that I was going to go into another phase of my life. You can call it retirement, but it's really more refirement. And so I've explained to the fans here that I'm going to be around and still be the number one Magic fan, but I've got projects that are really important to me, and I want to get on them while I still have my health and still have my thinking process. And so I'm off into some other adventures as well, Mike, but I'll always be known as the co-founder of the Magic, and many people around here call me Mr. Magic. So I carry that title with great pride.
As you should. So let's talk about some of those other ventures. What are the things that you have to look forward to here that you're excited about getting on to the next phase of your life?
Well, the most important one right now is the Pat Williams Leadership Library. I'm a book collector, and over the years, I've collected close to 30,000 books. And I've been very fortunate that First Baptist Church here in Orlando has provided for me the space to build out this library. It'll also house all my sports memorabilia. And so that's going to be a high priority. We've got a fundraise to get the building work done, and I'm going to be fully enmeshed in that. I want that to be my legacy here and beyond. And I'm going to continue to speak. I've got probably 20 books that I need to get written or want to write in the next 10 years. And so there's just a lot of stuff on my platter here that's important for me to get done.
All right. Describe for us what that library, what your vision is for the library and how it's going to function once it's up and running.
Well, it's going to be down many long hallways that the church has provided for me. There'll be wooden stacks, wooden shelves all the way up to the ceiling, down to the floor, because the hallways are so wide, and the library will be set up that way. It will not be a room. It'll be hallways where these books are going to be. And by category, baseball, basketball, football, miscellaneous sports, Civil War books, World War II books, faith-based books, leadership books, success books, all the areas that I'm interested in, and they'll be there by category. We've hired some very creative people to figure out, you know, how to work rather than just stacks of books. They are working on creative ways to display all of my memorabilia. It's going to be very, very interesting, and I'll be fully engaged.
Is that going to be open to the public?
Well, probably by appointment.
Gotcha.
Yeah, gotcha. By appointment. We have to figure all those things out. But the main thing is to get the funding here so that we can get the work started, and we're working hard on that.
When did you fall in love with books in your life?
I was 7 when my dad took me to my first big league ball game, and I became fascinated with baseball, and I wanted to learn all that I could about it. I was just learning how to read at that point. I didn't enjoy reading, but I did enjoy reading about baseball, and so my parents knew what to give me, you know, for birthdays or Christmas, and that was baseball books. And so I was surrounded with baseball books, and I absorbed them all as a youngster. And that passion has never left me. Later on in life, I developed other interests. I became absolutely buried in the Civil War period, and then the World War II period. Here of late, I've become very, very fascinated with the foundation of our country, the Revolutionary War period. Leadership has been a huge, huge topic in my life. I have well over 1,000 leadership books in this library. Success. What are the ingredients to have success? Well, I've been working on that for many years. So those are some of the topics. Presidential biographies will be there. These are some of the topics that have really been of interest to me, and they'll all have their special niche, you know, right here in this leadership library we're working on.
That's fantastic. Can you talk a little bit about your most current book that you have out, Character Carved in Stone? And it's based obviously on West Point and the values that are imparted there to the people that are fortunate enough to be able to attend West Point. Can you talk a little bit about that book and why it's so important to you, and just let people know what they can find if they go out and pick up a copy of that book?
The book is called Character Carved in Stone. And a few years ago, I was invited to speak at West Point to the Army team, sports teams there. And afterwards, they gave me a tour of the campus. We ended up in a little park called Trophy Point that looks out over the Hudson River. And in that park there, I noticed that there were 12 benches winding their way through the park. And I also noticed at the end of each bench, there was a different word carved into the stone. Words like courage and dedication, dignity, discipline, integrity, loyalty, trust, those kind of words. And yes, there was a backstory. The West Point class of 1934 donated those benches, selected the words, words that they thought were important to pass on to future generations of West Point graduates and future military leaders. And then my immediate reaction was, well, boy, this is a well-kept secret. I'd never heard of this. So we went to our publisher and told them about what we wanted to do, and they bought into it. And the book has come out this spring where Mike Krzyzewski, a Duke graduate, wrote the foreword for us, a West Point graduate wrote the foreword for us. And the end result is this book that's out there now, Mike, and I'm glad you brought it up, and I hope people enjoy it. It's called Character Carved in Stone. Amazon, a great way to order books, and Barnes & Noble is listing it in the business section.
Gotcha. Gotcha. So for people out there, you can find it on Amazon. You can find it on Barnes & Noble. It's a great book. It's a great read, just like Pat's other – how many books have you written, Pat, over 100?
110. This is 110th book, Mike, okay. And it's the most recent, and I hope people enjoy it. I think there's some real value there.
Real quick, what's your process for writing? Like how do you sit down and go about it? I know you obviously gain ideas from your own reading and your experiences, but what's your actual process? How long does it take you to get your ideas down on paper and go from idea to actually published book?
Well, the ideas come. I'm able then to get them into some sort of a form to pitch to publishers. You're only as good as your last book. and I continue to pass on these ideas that come to me in different forms. You never quite know where the next one's coming from. Character Carved in Stone. I mean, if they had just said after I spoke, we need to get you to the airport, I never would have taken that tour. I never would have seen those benches in Trophy Point, and that book never would have happened. So my point is that you never quite know where another idea is coming from, another thought. And that's why I tell people, eyes and ears open all the time. You never know where a good idea is, might pop your way. And that's what I've learned, and that's what I always try to do. And when a good idea comes, I grab it and see if I can go put it to market.
That's the way to do it. Absolutely. Pat, we're coming up here on an hour. I want to be respectful of your time.
Thank you, Mike.
Oh, you're welcome. Before we get out of here, if you wouldn't mind just sharing how people can reach out to you if they listen to the podcast and they have a question for you or they just want to say hello. And then also if there's anything that we did not touch on that you'd like to share before we get out of here, if you could go ahead and do that as well.
Well, Mike, you've been very thorough. Thank you. Just shoot me an email, pwilliams@orlandomagic.com, pwilliams@orlandomagic.com, and I'll get right back to you.
Fantastic. Pat, we can't thank you enough for jumping on with us. And to everyone out there, we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Head Start Basketball's Player Development Academy offers Cleveland area players a unique opportunity to improve their basketball skills. Regardless of a player's age, skill level, or position, training with Head Start Basketball will elevate your game to the next level. Do you want to improve your ball handling, become a better shooter, or develop into a more skilled, confident player? Our academy classes offer training that's designed to do just that. Our training sessions are innovative and will have you learning skills that are transferable to actual games. We have four different class skill levels for boys and girls, ages 4 and up.
All Player Development Academy classes will be held at the Strongsville Recreation Center. For more information or to get registered, please visit www.headstartbasketball.com.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast presented by Head Start Basketball.